And coming up right now is the Space Show. Welcome to the Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I am Andrew Rennie, and we're expecting a little later in the show to have Jay on Mission Control. Well, on this evening's The Space Show, heading to Mars. And to point the way, we have Wernher von Braun, United States President Bush. I'll let you work out which one of those. Jason Krusan and the Space Launch System, Jim Bridenstine and the big ticket item, Ian Whitchurst and the Barsoom Express.
Southern FM, the sounds of the Bayside.
Where you're listening to the Space Show with Andrew and Jay. On this evening's The Space Show, we are plotting a trajectory for humans to Mars. Can't say footsteps to Mars, because you cannot walk there. Nor can we say we will describe the road to Mars, because there cannot be a road there. So, trajectory, well, it will have to be. Someone who was a long-time advocate of sending humans to Mars was German rocketeer Wernher von Braun. He is here in conversation with American broadcaster Walter Cronkite on 1972, December the 6th, yes, you know that date, during the countdown to Apollo 17, which, as you know, was the final Apollo moon landing mission.
In these final hours before Apollo 17, some people are gloomy about the future of space exploration. Not among them is Dr. Wernher von Braun, the retired rocket expert who developed the big Saturn launch vehicles used to send men on their way to the moon. I talked with Dr. von Braun earlier this evening.
We will go to the moon again. There may be a 10-year gap or so, but when we do return to the moon, we will go there with our reusable space shuttle, with probably a reusable two-stage tug to fly from low Earth orbit onto lunar orbit, and land even on the moon itself with a vehicle that can return to a lunar orbit to be fueled up and do that portion of the trip also repeatedly. The net result will be that transportation cost to the lunar surface will be down to maybe one-tenth of what Apollo demands. And so we can really think of far more ambitious lunar surface missions, such as a semi-permanent installation on the moon, or traverses across the entire face of the moon, maybe of several thousand miles length, where would land a crew in one corner of the moon to pick it up a few weeks later in another location. I think all good things have an ending, and I consider Apollo a little bit, as it were, as the sailing ship and dog sled area to the South Pole. Well, next time we'll go to the South Pole, we'll go by turboprop airplane.
You said 10 years or so. You don't really expect that anything like that in 10 years. You're talking a much longer period.
Not necessarily. You see, the reusable space shuttle will be available in 1978, with first successful flights, and it can very definitely be an operational vehicle by 1980, which is 8 years away, and two more years will suffice to go back to the moon with the tug that is carried into orbit by the shuttle. So I'm not at all pessimistic.
Well, what is it in our makeup that is possible for us to get excited about an Apollo 11, man's first step on the moon, and within two short years of that time, be as blasé as the public seems to be today about this particular launch and the space program generally?
Well, I think it's the excitement of the new. I mean, it's like getting married, you know, being married. The love is still there and the excitement is still there, but it's no longer the honeymoon.
Now, von Braun's vision was not fulfilled. So step forward two decades and the first President Bush.
The time has come to look beyond brief encounters. We must commit ourselves anew to a sustained program of manned exploration of the solar system, and yes, the permanent settlement of space. To seize this opportunity, I'm not proposing a 10-year plan like Apollo. I'm proposing a long-range, continuing commitment. First, for the coming decade, for the 1990s, space station freedom, our critical next step in all our space endeavors, and next, for the new century, back to the moon, back to the future, and this time, back to stay. And then a journey into tomorrow, a journey to another planet, a manned mission to Mars.
Well, that didn't happen either. So jump now to the 2010s, and under the administration of President Obama, moves were eventually underway that might, sometime in the 2030s, get humans on their way to Mars. John Cusan is the Director of Advanced Exploration Systems Division of the Human Exploration and Operations Mission Directorate at NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C., and he had this to say about the Orion spacecraft and its role in future human deep space missions.
I'm going to start a little bit about planning out how we get from through this entire journey to Mars. Obviously, today we're starting with a very active human spaceflight program in low Earth orbit with the International Space Station. But going from where we're at today with the space station to distances like Mars is extremely challenging. We describe this kind of period of going from what we call Earth-reliant to an Earth-independent phase, meaning building the various systems and capabilities we need to advance human spaceflight to these far-off destinations. So we build upon that heritage with our International Space Station, and today we're testing advanced technologies and environmental life support systems, the habitation systems that we have, various autonomy and time delay experiments, along with our very active human research program on the ISS. These are teaching us some of the fundamentals we need to learn about living in space for long durations. With Orion, we're now entering into the next phase of advancing our capabilities into what we call our proving ground activities. In this proving ground, we are going to move further from Earth into the cislunar space and orbit around the lunar distances and look at how do we advance the habitation that we need for deep space transits to Mars? How do we look at the propulsion systems and large-scale moving of objects and living in that environment that we have in deep space? And preparing things like how to do EVAs in deep space and the overall mission objectives that we would want to advance on the way to Mars. All these will be building upon the fundamental capabilities that we need to take us to the distance of Mars and get us ready for not only the transit, but also the surface activities that would come with a Mars mission. I want to talk about specifically also about our asteroid redirect mission as well. This is another activity that will be coming in the future and how that may fold into our activities and capabilities that we need for Mars. With that, we're going to be advancing things like moving large objects in space, looking at how to do those EVAs in deep space, and then moving into next-generation advanced propulsion systems like solar electric propulsion that James will talk about here in a second. But it's really critical as we move from this Earth-reliant phase to Earth-independent phase that we spend some time advancing those capabilities, get the confidence in those systems, and figure out how to operate in these extreme environments safely and reliably on the long transit to Mars. It's interesting to think about these distances that we have that we're coming on these kind of journey. From the space station, we're a mere hours from returning a crew safely to a hospital if we had an anomaly and such in space. On distances like on our way to Mars, if we have anomalies, our actual scenarios for recovery are actually aborting to the surface of Mars, or at least a minimum, you're still on a long-duration mission for over a year trip home. So this requires us to advance those capabilities in a very stepwise and systematic way to allow us the confidence to send humans on these long trips. We're working very closely with our other mission directorates, and you'll hear that here from my colleagues in science and the technologies that we need from the technology folks as well.
Well, the asteroid redirect didn't happen either. Ryan, as you heard in the news this evening, is still hanging in there, but the necessary add-on modules that you'd need to go for a trip to Mars, there's no sign of that yet. Well, under the Trump administration, positive sounds are being made about Mars exploration with the mantra, forward to the moon and on to Mars. Here is NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine speaking a few weeks ago at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena at a ceremony to declare the end of the Opportunity Mars Exploration Rover mission.
With us now is the administrator to talk to us about what's on the future for NASA.
Thank you, Gay. I appreciate that very much. Jennifer, as long as we're going to bring back Spirit, let's bring back Sojourner as well and the two Vikings. Can we bring them all back?
We tried really hard.
We tried. Yeah. Look, I get it. I bring that up for a reason. Because I want to emphasize the legacy of this part of the NASA family. What has been done here at JPL is absolutely astonishing. And it goes back decades. And it's so impressive that because of what you have done here, we're going to be able to do a lot more on the surface of Mars in the future. In fact, when I was learning more and more about Spirit and Opportunity, I got to understand that these two spacecraft on the way to Mars actually flew through one of the worst solar storms, one of the worst solar flares that's ever been recorded. And so they had to actually shut down their computers and then reboot them, which was never intended in their design while they were in flight on the way to Mars. And yet somehow, this agency, in fact, JPL, was able to figure out how to get through that very scary part of the mission with a whole lot of investment and a whole lot of hopes on the line. That's an amazing achievement. I remember this part of the NASA family, and you guys hear me talk about the NASA family a lot. I remember when I was here for the InSight landing just a few short months ago, and we had a downlink from the International Space Station so that our astronauts could actually congratulate the folks in this room, many folks in this room and others that aren't here, on what an amazing accomplishment it was to land for the eighth time softly on the surface of Mars with a successful mission. That's what the NASA family is all about, bringing together all of the pieces of this agency to accomplish very special things. And of course, one of the special things that we have to figure out if we're going to fly humans to Mars is how to deal with those solar flares. Because that kind of an event with a human flight to Mars could be absolutely devastating. So that's one of the reasons we're doing the Parker Solar Probe right now with our heliophysics department to figure out kind of when are these solar flares going to occur and what are the impacts going to be. In fact, maybe even be able to predict accurately enough to know when and how to send humans to Mars and do it safely. Friends, there is a day coming when we're going to need the entire NASA family to come together and say we're going to put humans on Mars and humans are going to be working side by side with landers and rovers and robots, and it's going to be a whole of NASA. In fact, it will be, as a matter of fact, a whole of the world approach, because we're going to need international partners. And that brings me to Space Policy Directive 1 that the president signed just, a little over a year ago now. And what he said is we're going to go to the moon and we're going to go sustainably. And the question is why? Because when we go to the moon, we're going to live and work there for a period of time. We're going to retire risk. We're going to learn how humans can live on a world that's not our own. And we're going to take all of those things that we learn as an agency and we're going to apply them to Mars. We're going to replicate as much as possible what we learn at Mars. And friends, it's only going to be possible because this entire agency, this important part of the agency, this part of the NASA family, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, was blazing this trail, is currently blazing this trail, not just with Spirit and Opportunity and Sojourner and Viking 1 and Viking 2, but now with Mars 2020 and eventually a Mars return mission where we're going to be able to look at samples and determine if there's a biosignature in there. Friends, the goal is to discover life on another world. That's what we're trying to achieve. And because of so many great people in this room, friends, we are well on our way to doing that. couple of things I want to make sure everybody in the audience at home understands. In fact, because of the Curiosity rover, we now know that there are complex organic compounds on the surface of Mars. That does not guarantee that there is life on Mars, but it increases the probability. We now know that the methane cycles on Mars are commensurate with the seasons of Mars. That doesn't guarantee there's life on Mars, but it increases the probability. We know that there's water 12 kilometers, liquid water 12 kilometers under the surface of Mars. All of these things collude to say there is a lot we need to learn, and friends, we're going to do it quickly. And your legacy here at JPL and part of this NASA family is critical to achieving those objectives. So once again, thank you for having me. Congratulations on an amazing opportunity mission.
And that was Jim Bridenstine, NASA Administrator. Now, Ian Whitchurch from Newman Space Systems in Brampton, Adelaide, is interested in the Barsoom Express. He has an idea to get from Earth to Mars in 3 months by solar electric propulsion. He spoke at the Australian Space Research Conference at RMIT University.
I'd like to introduce Ian Whitchurch of Newman Space Systems, another startup that's doing some exceptional things. I think this is a really good example of a company that's looking at the top level first, okay, and I say it that way because they're looking at products which reduce the barrier to entry to space, that make it easier to do space and more capable to do space, and I think that's one of the futures that we could have in Australia. So a rocket engine, good example of technology coming straight out of university that they're working to commercialize. So with that in mind, over to you, Ian.
Yeah. Good afternoon. My name's Ian Whitchurch. I'm one of the principals at Neumann Space. We've also got a payload on Bartolomeo, where we're setting up what we're calling the Facility for Australian Space Tests. The reason we got that is to test the drive, which we hope will enable things like this. I'm talking about a concept, the Barsoom Express, which is designed to do Earth orbit to Mars orbit faster than a Hohmann transfer. Essentially, it's a space tug on steroids, putting the pedal to the metal with solar electric propulsion and seeing what we could do. The first thing is high theory. There are two ways to do space exploration. There's the way that Wernher von Braun told us to do it in the early 1950s, and there's the wrong way. The wrong way involves very large, heavy lift vehicles, gigantic launches which try and send everything you will need all up at once. The right way involves space stations, specialist craft. It's about orbital staging. It was described in Collier's magazine, a mass market American magazine in October 1952. This is, through the miracle of the internet, available today. I recommend you have a look at that. It is the prehistory of space exploration. Even if you believe in large rockets that go up at once and do everything at once, it is still worth looking at, von Braun, Lay and Whipple's architecture for how they believed we should get to the Moon, Mars and beyond. What I've done is mostly updating their plan with some new technology. This is the first important step. The International Space Station, which is up today. It is your first staging point. It is where we can change from chemical rockets that provide a lot of thrust quickly and get you through the atmosphere and into orbit, where you can change to higher efficiency electric propulsion. The second key technology is the Neumann drive, invented by Dr. Patrick Neumann, while he was a student at the University of Sydney. Applied Physics Letters have just published his paper together with Professors Bilek and McKenzie on a center-triggered magnesium-fueled cathodic arc thruster that uses sublimation to deliver a record high specific impulse. It's a peer-reviewed paper. It's in APL. I commend it to you. The Neumann drive works by passing a high current, low voltage discharge in a vacuum. Usually when you pass an electric current through a solid block of metal, like you do in a bar heater or an electric stove, it heats up and then melts and then vaporizes. It turns out if you do this at about 2.5 kiloamps for about 200 millionths of a second in a hard vacuum, using the correct amount of joules for the material you're dealing with, some of that material goes directly to ionization and escapes the cathode, tens to hundreds of kilometers a second, creating thrust. Molybdenum is one of the materials that has been tested in the research program. It is providing 20 micronewtons per watt and a specific impulse of 5,000 seconds. The fact that a Neumann drive uses solid metal fuel rods means that it is much more simple to refuel in vacuum microgravity conditions than liquid or gaseous fuels. We don't have to deal with pumps, we don't have to deal with tankage, we've got a thing which we can grab at one end and move to where it needs to go. We've got a thing that we could, if we needed to, leave in orbit until it was needed. We don't have issues of boil off, we don't have issues of keeping the supercritical liquid at the correct temperature that provide issues for long-term fuel storage. There is a third key technology, which is modern, high-efficiency solar panels. One of the products that was talked about in Melanie's talk earlier was the high-altitude recon drone that Airbus Defence and Space have built, the Zephyr project, which has been sold to the RAF in the UK. The solar panels on that are built by an American company called Microlink Devices. Their patented epitaxial liftoff technology is providing a power efficiency of 1100 watts per kilogram solar power at 1 AU. That is about 5 times better than the solar panel that you can buy off Azure Space or Boeing. This is not a product with a lot of flight history, but the ability to use very high specific power solar panel will enable us to do things with solar electric propulsion that we hadn't previously been able to do, which is why it's a key technology. Another point we have to deal with is that Earth's neighbourhood is dangerous. The Van Allen belts surround Earth, mostly around the equator, and are very bad for humans and for solar panels and for just about everything we'd send into space. You don't want to spend a lot of time in an environment with multi-electron volt high-energy particles. Therefore, my solution is to start the Barsoom Express at the Earth-Moon Lagrange point 2, a point where the Earth and the Moon's gravity cancel out and things can sit there and need a very low amount of delta V. I've got to stop at this point. Everybody knows what delta V is the way I'm using it. You need about 10 metres per second per year to keep things where they are at L2. This means, for example, we could store solid fuel rods there. The United Launch Alliance are also looking at L2 as a base for their ACES, liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen refueling depots. There is a very good paper by ULA that is on their website about the ACES concept. I commend it to you. I would very much like to see ACES happen, because taking up an entire new spaceship together with your fuel load strikes me as a tad wasteful. People would go to and from the International Space Station by a fast passenger shuttle. Equipment and fuel would go to and from the ISS to the second staging point of AML2 by solar electric propulsion that uses heavy cover glass on the solar cells and magnesium fuel, because we're taking stuff. We don't really mind as much how long it takes to get there as if we're taking people who will need much more looking after, will need many more consumable supplies. Solar electric propulsion tugs in general are characterised by bigger solar panels and smaller fuel tanks. This is an example of a solar tug using the Rollout Solar Array that I got off Aviation Week. We'll notice that the relative size of the solar panels is much larger than the rest of the vehicle. This is something that if you're going to go down the solar path, you just accept that you need more solar panel. SCP tugs have been discussed extensively. They are part of NASA's current architecture for going to Mars. These articles, Mercer and Olson, Brophy and Nadari, is something that I would commend to you. Barsoom Express has been benchmarked against those. The basic architecture involves, per tonne of tug, 125 kilos of solar cells, 12.5% solar by mass. Using Microlynx cells, this will get us 125 kilowatts of solar power at 1 AU. 50 kilos of thin substrate and structure for the solar cells. Because we are planning on operating from EML2, away from the Van Allen belts, away from the atomic oxygen there's around Earth's atmosphere, we get to conserve on the cover glass. 50 kilos of Newman drive inductor and capacitors, assuming 10 cathode anode pairs per tonne at a pulse rate of 10 a second, dropping 125 joules over 300 microseconds into the molybdenum. 200 kilos of molybdenum fuel per tug. 60 kilos of direct drive power processing unit. There's a concept that Brophy introduced for his designs for a solar electric tug. Essentially, you design your solar panel arrays so that you can pour the power straight into the drive rather than putting it through a power processing unit first. It's an aggressive approach, but it saves on the power processing units. The other point I would make is that Hall effect thrusters are the main form of electric propulsion that is used at the moment. The higher a voltage on the Hall effect thruster, the better it works. So a lot of your high power Hall effect thrusters will be looking at running north of 500 volts. Newman drives aren't like that. They're quite happy to operate at a lower voltage. If you increase the power, you increase the pulse frequency to get more thrust. 200 kilos of cooling, 20% of your entire mass of cooling, because we're putting a lot of watts through things. 150 kilos for structure, avionics and so on. People who are good at quick maths will notice that I'm missing about, I believe, 150 kilos. That's extra mass for when our assumptions don't turn up. So that if we did need cover glass, if we did need a non-direct drive power unit, it's a viable design. The performance at 1 AU, 1 tonne of tug plus 1 tonne of cargo using molybdenum has 1.25 newtons of thrust. That means it'll accelerate at 2.25 metres per second per hour, 54 metres a day. At 10% fuel fraction, we've got 5.16 kilometres of delta V. The route planning, I've taken from Mercer and Olson, for their plan of a fully solar electric tug to go to Mars. Solar electric propulsion courses are more complicated than the Hohmann transfers that are generally on lookup tables. How fast you accelerate has effects. The relative positions of the planets, while they have less effect as a Hohmann transfer, still have an effect. I admit I am not good at navigation. I cheated and copied the numbers from a NASA study. They thought that we would need 2,064 metres per second to go from Earth-Moon L2 and then a spiral down of 647 metres. This is within the 5.16 kilometres a second of Delta V. We've got on board the Barsoom Express carrying its own mass. It also fits a back-working I did on Mercer and Olson's design that involved a Hall effect thruster using xenon that had 2870 seconds of specific impulse. It fit those characteristics. So the voyage there, at AML2 we've got 154 kilowatts of power. Mars, we've only got 40% of that. Now, this raised an interesting point, which is not in the paper because it was done yesterday. We might be better off going via Venus. Go inwards where you get more power and then do a gravity turn around Venus. Someone who's a lot better at space navigation than me can test this out. We need 2,700 metres. We can do it in the 90 days. The exact time will depend on the relative positions of Earth and Mars as you spiral out. This is faster than a Hohmann transfer orbit. The roadmap for this, there is some very aggressive engineering in this design. Test the individual elements. The Bartolomeo module is where the Neumann drive can be tested in space. It is where I plan on testing Microlink's solar panel as well, to see how well their thin film solar stands up to the rigours of space with various coatings on it. The 12 months of Bartolomeo modulars on the ISS will give us a good time to space test technologies. After that, a scaled down version. A 12.5 kilowatt space tug still has commercial uses. It would be useful for providing life extension for communication satellites. With the kind of delta V that we've got, it would certainly be the core of something that could visit near-Earth objects. There are things you could do with it beyond being a technology testbed. Establish the fuel depot at Earth-Moon L2. Test the minimalist solar panels at Earth-Moon L2. Will they last the trip? And then we're in a position to take the Barsoom Express. Thank you.
Could you explain where the name Barsoom comes from?
John Carter, Warlord of Mars. It was his name for the planet Mars. Edgar Rice Burroughs novels that I read as a kid. Science fantasy at its best, I commend them.
So why do you need to test it on the ISS? Can't you test it in vacuum chambers or other such terrestrial facilities?
We can, but the ISS is also going to let us test it in a space environment with radiation, atomic oxygen, and all the other things we can't test as well. The drive has been tested, but the engineering needs to be tested as well. Without having tested it in space, it's not going to have a high enough technology readiness level to be able to get people accepting it. It's got to get tested in space. It can't. It's been tested in the lab. We've got good results. That makes sense. But space things have to go to space.
Is there a way to test it, to miniaturize the thing and test it on CubeSat instead? Because testing on ISS seems to be a bit worrying in the case that it might actually change the ISS trajectory when you actually test the propulsions.
The Neumann drive has an issue with scaling it down to a CubeSat size, is that we need a capacitor bank to be able to deliver power over 200 to 300 microseconds, and we need an inductor coil that will jack things up to about 2.5 kiloamps. I can't see a good way to put that into a CubeSat. We might be able to fit that into something that weighs 25 kilos on a really good day, but it's not going to go on a CubeSat. The second thing is that Christian Steinler, the Bartolomeo project manager at Airbus DS, is quite aware of what we want to do on the Bartolomeo module. The solution when discussing with him is to have two of them pointing in opposite directions, cancelling the thrust, because one of my rules is not to piss off people with nuclear weapons, and I don't want to be explaining to all of them where I put their ISS.
Okay. Just wondering, what typical level of payload for the space exploration mission? Well, how heavy would be?
Sorry, for the which mission?
For the space exploration missions. Because you say you want to land onto...
Payloads for space exploration missions can be a low of 2 kilograms. I believe that the Curiosity rover that landed on Mars masses 4 ton. Is that a correct guess? Mm-hmm. How much? 1 ton. So, yeah, that's the range of the things that we've taken on exploration missions.
On the Space Show, we have been at RMIT University at the Australian Space Research Conference, where Ian Whitchurch from Norman Space Systems, from Brampton and Adelaide, have been talking about the Barsoom Express. I hope you caught my question about that. Well, I am Andrew Rennie. On Mission Control, we have Jay. So, once again, space.asn.au for the Space Association of Australia. I'm Andrew Rennie. On Mission Control, we've had Jay, and we're handing over soon to Nick Black and Pebble Hayes.